Focus with Clem Ryan. Text or WhatsApp on 0833 97 97 97.
Well, a very good afternoon to you and welcome aboard for Kildare Focus. Between now and three, we have some very interesting topics for you. In just a moment, we'll be discussing tips on how to cut down on alcohol consumption, particularly with the onset of the Christmas season when everybody can get carried away with all the media push that goes on around the celebrations of the occasion. We'll also be telling you about some burglary tips, given how our Gardaí frequently remind us here weekly on Crime Time about burglaries around the county, how you might prevent those. We'll return to the item that we had a little bit of an audio problem with yesterday. Apparently the problem was at my end rather than Dr. Brendan O'Shea's end, because everybody was telling me afterwards he sounded fine, but my problem was I couldn't hear him properly in studio, so maybe the problem was with my headphones and that. We're talking, of course, is there such a thing as the male menopause? Of course there is. We men know all about the menopause, don't we, lads? Yeah, right. When we get a little sniffle, oh, the world's about to end. But anyway, we'll hear more from Brendan today. And the GRA's Kildare representative, Garda Jonjo O'Connell, will join us to discuss the latest statistics on the number of Gardaí resigning, it continuing to grow, and on a day in which the Garda Commissioner Drew Harris was addressing an Oireachtas committee about the whole situation of morale in the Gardaí, the resignations, etc., etc. We'll also have a couple of other interesting topics to bring you during the course of the afternoon as well. And your messages 0833 97 97 97 gets you WhatsApp or text 0833 97 97 97. Email studio at kfmradio.com, or you can speak with our Hannah in production on 045 901 490. So don't forget, your opinions are always of interest to us to find out what you're thinking about the issues affecting you, not alone throughout County Kildare, but the listeners in other counties as well. Okay, let's begin then with first item we have for you today. And that is in relation to a headline I saw lately. Sober Curious, a psychologist tips for cutting down on alcohol. Because, of course, as we well know, while alcohol can be pleasant if consumed in moderate terms, it's also associated with many physical and mental ill health hazards. The ways in which people drink have changed over the last couple of years, in particular with social media references. You know that terrible term of wine o'clock? That was so prevalent during COVID. Then there were various Zoom parties. I remember all of those, watching images of people gargling away on Zoom, of all things. And then we have this, given the season we're in it, the stocking up of drink and whatever for Christmas. Now, as we said, in moderation, it can be a pleasant experience, but the problem is the problem when it becomes a problem. Let's find out more now, because we're joined by Dr. Garrett McGovern, who's a GP specialising in addiction medicine, medical director and founder of the Priority Medical Clinic. Good afternoon, Dr. McGovern.
Good afternoon, Clem.
Thank you for joining us. Did I sum it up adequately there?
Yes, you did. That was very good. You have it. One, it seems like a time immemorial bad relationship with alcohol in Ireland, and I don't think it's slowing down, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, we have always had this caricature of the Irishman with a whiskey bottle or a pint of whatever in one hand and the shillelagh in the other hand. And whether we like it or not, the first thing we can start with today, there is a perception, and I wonder if that's been added to by multinational events, whether it is the World Rugby Cup or the World Soccer Cup, that further afield, we're often, you know, a barrage of images come to us of Irish fans celebrating, and that celebration is usually to do with a surfeit of alcohol. So has that not sort of embedded the caricature of the drinking or drunken Irish internationally?
Yeah, I think it is, and you raise a very important point. I mean, if you were to do an experiment and just listen to or watch social media or news websites, particularly listening on the radio and watching on the telly, if you have a reference to a team winning something, so if you think of, say, a team winning the All-Ireland, you know, the, let's say it was Kerry. I don't know when Kerry last won the All-Ireland, but...
Oh, my God. Always... God forgive you, Garrett McGovern. God forgive you.
I'm having a little go at Kerry there. Right. Apologies. That's the dub in me. It's the bad dub in me. But yeah. Come here to me. You'll often hear, you know, the drinks will be flowing in Cathair Sibhain tonight and all that sort of stuff. Now, as if that's a very good thing and everybody should imbibe. And we have what I often call the reverse moral high ground, and that is that if you ever go to a social event and you might be driving your car and you go in and they say, what do you want? What would you like to drink? It's nearly always an alcoholic drink that's offered. And you say, I'm not drinking. There's almost like, it's almost like one of those scenes in a movie where you walk into the pub and the music stops and everyone stops what they were doing. I mean, it seems like this dramatic event, and there's an element of the, you know, Mrs. Doyle, go on. You know, they don't care that you're driving. They don't care that you're not drinking. They wouldn't care necessarily whether you had a drink problem and you're trying to stay sober. There's this feeling of you should be drinking, because that's what we do. And we're not the only country.
On a personal perspective, I can share that, because I don't drink now. Gave it up nearly a year ago. But not for any reason other than health. Just, I felt, look, what's the point in having a headache? What's the point in being bleary-eyed or whatever else? And it wasn't as if I was... you know, lashing into it or anything else like that. But at the end of the day, having read some other people's testimonies as well as to how well they felt and this and that, I decided. But I had that in not too long ago when someone said to me, have a jar. No. Why? Yeah. Why? I'm not drinking. You're joking me. What's wrong with you? So there is that. That's very, very true indeed. But also when we got on to COVID, what happened there? Because certainly this wine o'clock and parties and then drinking moved from the pubs by and large into the homes, and that became a real, real problem in terms of, did we measure what we were drinking?
Yeah, no, you're spot on. I mean, it was interesting in what happened in COVID initially was interesting, because in the very immediate when the lockdowns happened, we found that there was hardly anybody making phone calls to come and, you know, get treatment for obvious reasons. So there was a sort of a quiet period of about a month, 6 weeks. Then it went the other way. And I got more and more phone calls about people who had began to displace their drinking from either in two ways. One was socially to, as you say, in the house. But also another interesting trend happened, and that was a lot more people were either furloughed or were working, you know, working at home.
Yeah.
And what it unearthed actually was a drink problem that was already there, but now because they were beginning to drink earlier in the day. And what people would do is, instead of drinking at the wine o'clock, which is usually around six when they go home and they have start to have their dinner, they might pour a drink when they get in. This was now happening more sort of 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, sometimes earlier. In fact, some patients told me that one of the reasons that they came to me was that they were doing a lot of Zoom, and the problem was that it was getting a bit hairy on Zoom, because they would be drinking out of eyeshot with their glass of wine while they were doing work Zoom. So they realised that there could be a difficulty here. Turned out there was a big difficulty in that they were not only drinking from earlier, but they were finishing, you know, either at the same time they would normally finish, would be about 9 or 10 o'clock, or sometimes later. Yeah. In other words, they were getting fairly moderately, severely alcohol dependent. And they, instead of having one bottle of wine a night, it could be two bottles of wine a day, and in some occasions more. And sometimes the type of drink shifted from a less concentrated beer or wine. Before, wine is fairly concentrated, to spirits.
Right. Before we get into an overall what you might advise in terms of tips if you want to give it up, I was actually surprised at myself at the end of the day about not missing it, because enjoyed the few gargles at the weekend. Very, very modest now, I have to say. But I thought, ultimately, you know, maybe I'll miss it. Away on holidays lately, I said, that'll be a real challenge. Never even thought of it. And I'm not putting that out there as a virtue or anything else. But I often wonder, that much of the drinking that goes on, it's done out of what we call maybe habit. It's habitual. It's what everybody else does. There's a societal norm around it. And I wonder if how many people ever say, why do I drink? Why would I have a pint of stout or a short rather than a soft drink? Are we afraid of something psychologically?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that, and it was mentioned in that article, you know, from Gabor Maté, who talks about, you know, trauma. I don't think all addictions are necessarily easily linked to trauma. I mean, I work with, you know, some very marginalised communities who have a range of problems, including heroin problems, crack cocaine, and trauma is particularly to the forefront in many of those populations. Now, trauma is there, but I don't think it's simply explained by that, in the sense that I have seen patients who developed, and this is a group, interestingly, that you wouldn't expect, and they are retirees, so people who've retired, hardly touched alcohol or very little of it, and now have all the time in the world in their hands, and suddenly you're seeing someone in their early 70s coming to see me who finds it very, very difficult to come to terms with the fact that they were going down to the pub with friends innocently initially, and then beginning to go down there every day, and they might go down to play dominoes or have a chat or whatever, and it looked very social, which in of itself is great. The problem was not so great when you're drinking alcohol and drinking alcohol every day. So they went from kind of one day a week to 2 to 3 days a week to almost every day, and then they were cranking their use of it up, and exactly at the wrong time of their life. The very time you need to look after yourself is when, you know, you're getting into your advancing years. So it's very sneaky sometimes. It's not easily explained by trauma, although there's no doubt about it. That's a huge risk factor for addiction in general. But I think once it's a form of conditioning, really. And as one lady said it to me once, she said, you know, I don't know where this came from, she said, but I've just developed one dirty, horrible habit. And I thought it was a very good way of looking at it. That's exactly what it was.
Is it not also, Dr. Garrett McGovern, is it not also that our perception of drugs in this country doesn't include alcohol? Like you've just been outlining there, when we talk of addiction, the first thing that springs to mind is not drink, it's not alcohol, it's heroin, it's cocaine, it's whatever else. And because it's legal, as is tobacco and whatever else, and because it's a societal norm, is that not the huge danger really as well?
Yeah, I think the problem people have is, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think people think because a drug is illegal that that's how we decide, you know, what the level of harm is. I mean, alcohol, if you look at it across the board, is one of the most dangerous drugs of all the drugs in many ways, because it's widely used. The perception of its harms probably are not there. And we do have in this country a relationship, and we do tend to call it alcohol or drugs, when in actual fact they're all drugs. They're all psychoactive drugs, whether it be cocaine, amphetamine, heroin, benzodiazepines, cannabis. They're all drugs. They all have a site of action that they work at, and they have all different types of effects. Alcohol is no different. Maybe, perhaps, people think because you drink it, maybe, and because it's legal, it must be different. Not a bit of it. The fact of the matter is, it is a drug. And, you know, if alcohol wasn't legal, alcohol would be in the same bracket as those other drugs. It would be viewed a lot less differently. I think at the top of this, you were talking about, you know, you were alluding to alcohol advertising. I mean, the alcohol advertising is quite sinister, because, you know, now they're beginning to, you know, get around restrictions by advertising non-alcoholic versions of alcoholic drugs, alcohol drinks. Now, it probably might surprise you, I'm actually in favour. It's one of the positive things that the alcohol industry have done, to have alternatives. And I have patients myself who use alcohol zero alternatives. But the marketing of it is a bit sneaky. So if you look at, say, there's many, I don't want to mention any brands on the radio, but there are many of the alcohol versions that, the non-alcohol versions, the bottles are the same, or the presentation of it is the same. So that's just alcohol advertising.
Well, I have to say that I saw that very same image that we might be talking about on social media the other night, and I said, there's absolutely no difference between that and the pint that would have alcohol content. I wonder, is there a difference in the taste? And I can see how psychologically, subliminally, or whatever else, the message is continually going through. So, from your perspective, what advice would you give to people overall regarding alcohol?
Well, I think, you know, I think the article alluded to, you know, weekly units. I'm mixed feelings about units, because some of the units are different in different countries. I mean, if you look at the US, they're very much for 14 units a week for a man and 7 units a week for a woman, which is 7 standard drinks or 14 standard drinks. That would be about half a pint of, say, medium-strength beer or, you know, a glass of wine or a short spirit that we serve in a pub. There, that's what a unit is. Some people think a unit is a pint. It's not a pint. It's half a pint. But I always think when you're counting units, you're already in a little bit of trouble, to be honest with you. And I think the unit system is grand. I mean, it is a guide. There's no question about that. But I think a better relationship to have with alcohol is either one of two relationships. You saw in the article with Sober Curious, you know, people think that if you give up drink, even for a period of time, but if you give it up, and some people do Dry January and, you know, Sober October and all that sort of stuff, don't assume that it's going to be bad or you're going to miss it. Actually, you'll feel better. Now, you said yourself that you haven't drank in a year. You feel better. There's no question about your mental health.
I was more surprised. In fact, I say if there was anything I found unusual, it was the old idea of the hands, you know. And I would have confined my couple of jars to just the weekend and whatever else. Yeah. I'd have found sitting in front of the telly in the early days, now what? What are they going to do? And, you know, fiddling around with the phone and things like that. But I have to say, as an encouragement to people, that aside from everybody you told, and I didn't go around telling people, it's just when someone would ask you, are you going for a jar? And you say no. Aside from everyone immediately assuming I must have an alcohol problem, it soon just basically didn't become part of the daily existence anymore.
Exactly right. And you know, I often think that the attraction towards alcohol is because alcohol kind of isn't real life. People want to escape psychologically from a place maybe that's less enjoyable to a place that's more enjoyable. And the concept of that, I have to say, Clem, is perfectly reasonable. If you're able to go out, have a couple of drinks and maybe not drink for a couple of weeks, or take it or leave it, I think is the kind of layperson's phrase. Well, that's wonderful. There's a lot of Irish people. It's estimated that probably as many as, you know, between 50 and 60% of people who are the status of a drinker, I'm talking about adults now, just specifically adults, people over the age of 18, they probably overdo it. They probably are go beyond, in different ways, they will drink beyond the recommended guidelines, or they'll binge. Binge is very common. So, you know, binging is 5 units, you know, or more in a single setting, which people laugh at, and I can understand that. You know, that's 2.5 pints. As one fellow said to me once, that wouldn't wet me beak in the first half an hour. I can understand that. But the other thing is you, one of the things you did, and I don't know that you knew you were doing this, is you lost the grow for drink. Well, you certainly will lose it after a year. And when you lose the grow for drink, as I say, you probably will realise that actually you don't need that drug anymore. There's nothing, you can still enjoy yourself, in other words. You've probably found that. You can still get pleasure out of things you do in life. You can still socialise. You know, as I always say, you can still go to a restaurant and meet somebody. You can still laugh. You can still have the same friends. And the great thing about it is you can get into a car and drive it safely without being over the limit. You can do more not drinking than drinking. A lot of people don't realise that. They think that you're inhibited because you don't drink. It is true to say it's very, very hard if you've been part of a group where there's heavy drinking and you go out on weekends. You're probably not going to be able to do that for long. You might be able to go out for a couple of hours in the pub, but the staying all night for sing songs possibly might be a bit difficult because a lot of people are drunk. And I don't know if you've been sober around drunk people.
I was just about to make the point that your tolerance of, we'll say, everyone being merry and high and being ridiculous and enjoying themselves enormously, your tolerance begins to lower proportionately as you go along in relation to that. You've mentioned the term there, that it is a very dangerous drug and we need to have a clearer perception. We've often discussed that with representatives from Coonwira here on the programme and other people as well. So, is it a case that you would say to people, just to sum up, if I might, Dr. Garrett McGovern, is it a case of saying to people, if you drink, maybe do an assessment of how often and how much, and then tailor your behaviour accordingly in the interests of your long-term health?
Very much so. But also, there are people, there is a group of people that will be worth mentioning here also. There are people I treat who are not necessarily addicted to alcohol. In fact, I know they're not addicted to alcohol. They could go probably a couple of weeks. They're usually younger. But when they drink, probably about maybe 5 to 6 times a year, they and probably in a strange sort of irony to it is it's because they don't really have great tolerance to alcohol, so they get very, very drunk, very disorientated. In the case of women, it can be really dangerous situations. They put themselves into vulnerable situations, men and women, to be honest with you, but women have an added vulnerability, you might say. And it's very frightening for the family, you know, blackouts, not arriving home, not knowing where you were, complete loss of memory, putting yourself in really risky positions. So that's a thing to also think about. It generally happens in younger people, but it's frightening. And I treat people, I've more than I probably should have in terms of the number of patients who suffer from that. In the case of men, sometimes terribly aggressive and getting into fights and all sorts of things like that. That's a problem. It's not necessarily addiction, but it's problematic drinking. It's binge problematic drinking. You really need to get a handle on that, because there can be life-changing consequences as a result of that.
Okay, and I just want to reiterate, in just sharing my own experience, I'm not doing it to portray a virtuous person or anything else. It's just a decision I took for no other reason. I do a fair bit of running. And I just felt that trying to run the next morning after just having a few glasses of wine the night before just wasn't making sense. And from that point of view, to emphasise to people that in that case, once you got over the first couple of days of, well, normally on this night I'd have a couple of drinks or whatever else, it ceases to be a reality. It ceases to be anything in my experience. And I know I'm lucky in that, because I'm not what Dr. McGovern is pointing out, at a stage where the habit has become such that dependency is beginning to creep in. Now, I know that you run a specialised clinic, Dr. Garrett McGovern. You're at 6 Pembroke Cottages in Main Street, Dundrum.
Yeah.
I'm going to give out the number for it, with your permission, in a couple of minutes' time.
Yeah.
And we'll have some numbers for AA as well. But when somebody comes to you, just briefly, if you would, what would be the process?
Yeah, so basically the way my kind of clinic works is, when someone comes to me, I usually set up what we call an initial consultation, and I encourage people to, if they like, to bring a family member or a spouse or someone along with I offer that up, because sometimes people don't want to come on their own. And usually it's just an overview session, really. I just try and get a handle on it. It's very off the cuff. We don't get anything into anything deep. I just want to get a kind of an overview of what may be intervention, level of intervention they need. And usually what I do when I'm finished that is I give them an opportunity to ask questions. Is I don't want them to make any decision on what they need to do right now. So I'm very, very big on this. I give them some information, some articles that I would have written in relation to alcohol that might be helpful to them. And their own good time, if they feel they'd like to come back, haven't taken advice from me. And I like to give them advice on the spot, even if they don't come back. I'll try and give them some tips as to what to do. And then they'll come back to me and they'll say, look, I think I need a bit more of an intervention. I might be a little bit more intensive intervention, or one-to-one, or whatever it is. And then we'll get stuck into the treatment. So it's a combination of kind of sometimes medication, often not. I'm big into, obviously, the physical and mental health side of it. We do things like cognitive behavioural therapy, which is challenging kind of beliefs about alcohol, changing the narrative in terms of looking at alcohol a little bit more from a harm point of view rather than a benefit point of view. Counselling is always in there, because there's nearly always issues. Sometimes there's some significant issues. So we do a lot of that. And I do family kind of therapy also, where we bring the person in, sometimes the family member on their own if they need a bit of counselling. So trying to be as holistic as we can, you know.
And I have to say, you articulate the whole situation very, very well. We're going to give out the contact details for yourself, the phone number, and indeed for AA in general, Al-Anon, in a couple of minutes' time, if people at home listening and they're interested and want to get their pens. Other than that, all we're saying is, listen, this is the information about it. Alcohol is one of the most dangerous drugs about, along with all the others that are mentioned. And we're not saying don't drink. What we're saying is just be aware of what you're drinking. Because certainly, any time I've had a few jars, I have totally enjoyed them. And I just changed it for lifestyle reasons. But so that's all we're doing. We're putting it out there. And meanwhile, Dr. Gary McGovern is a GP specialising in addiction medicine. He's medical director and founder of the Priority Medical Clinic. And we'll give you the address for that in a couple of minutes' time. Gary, thank you very much for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure, Clem. Thank you very much.
Very interesting indeed, I have to say. And after the break, get your pen and we'll give out those contact details.
Kildare Focus with Clem Ryan. Text or WhatsApp on 0833 97 97 97.
Right, a listener says, my daughter is in her 40s. She drinks a bottle of wine every night at home. Does she have a drink problem? I'm not a doctor and I'm not an expert in this area, but I think if somebody's drinking a bottle of wine every night, if not a problem now, definitely there's going to be a problem. So I think that needs to be addressed and maybe advice given. The problem is, of course, that you can advise until the cows come home. But ultimately, a person cannot be changed unless they're ready to change themselves. So I'm informed reliably by those in my social circle as well. Now, let's go back to Hannah for the moment, because Hannah, ahead of we doing some tips about burglaries, you have a couple of numbers for us that you can give out there.
Yeah, so I have a few numbers here for helpline. So I have HSE Drug and Alcohol Helpline. That's 1800 459 459. That's 1800 459 459. They're open Monday to Friday from 9:30 in the morning until 5:30 p.m. And they have an email at helpline@hse.ie. Then there's Alcoholics Anonymous Ireland, is 01-842-0700. That's 01-842-0700. They're open Monday to Friday from 9:30 till 5 p.m. And their email is gso@alcoholicsanonymous.ie. And we also have Al-Anon Ireland, which is 01-873-2699. That's 01-873-2699. And they're open every day from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m.
And they are for relations, relatives of people who might have a problem. So I'd say to that woman, maybe you'd like to have a chat with somebody on the HSE or whatever else, if your daughter is drinking a bottle of wine every night. Just my own perception is that that wouldn't be a healthy trend at all. And Dr. Garrett McGovern's details there, his medical practice is at 6 Pembroke Cottages, Main Street, Dundrum. And the telephone number to contact him, if you wish, is 01-291-6153. That's 01-291-6153, Dr. Garrett McGovern. And let's not forget Coonwerry in Athy, of course. What a fantastic job everybody does there as well. So thanks for that. Meanwhile, Hannah, it's that time of year when the evenings are getting short, long, dark evenings, often the friendly conditions for burglars. And data from the Garda Analysis Service shows that one third of burglaries are through the front door, with most burglars using their own body to gain entry. In other words, give it a big shoulder. Back doors are targeted 26% of break-ins, back windows 24%, front windows are used 8% of cases, which makes our experience rare enough, I suppose. Nearly half of these recorded burglaries occur between 5 p.m. and 11 p.m. They were after computers, phones, gaming consoles, stuff like that. So I wonder what tips we can take, Hannah, in terms of protecting our home and home security. So starting with the first one.
Yeah, so I think the first one is a pretty obvious one. I think some people would do it already, and that's whether you're at home or going out, turn some lights on. You can use light timers if you're not going to get home before it gets dark. These are a good one to use just to make it look like someone's in the house. And then the second one is another obvious one, but lock all doors and windows, as 1 in 4 of the summertime break-ins involve entry through an unsecured access point, and I'm sure the same can go for winter break-ins as well. Next one, this is an obvious one that I do at home as well. This is store keys away from windows and letterboxes. I don't think people realise how important this one is.
Hannah, don't be telling all the burglars what you do.
Just this one is so important. People don't realise that burglars can make little contraptions to reach into your letterbox
Fishing.
Through your windows to catch your keys or any valuables. So that one's really important.
Yeah, also, what else have we got?
So record details of valuables and don't keep large amounts of cash at home. And if you're going away and your house is going to be vacant, don't go posting your holiday all over social media. And if you feel you need to show off your break in the winter sun, respect the privacy of any friends or family who might be away with you and don't want to be tagged in your posts. Store ladders and tools away safely so you're not actually helping the burglar to gain access to your house. And while it's a good idea to make the house look occupied when it's empty, there are things the burglars look for, like lights constantly being on during the day. So this is when a timer comes into use and put it on a random setting. So don't leave your blinds or curtains fully closed when away. And if you're going away for any length of time, ask the neighbours to take your post-milk deliveries in for you. And lastly, although we're told we're probably targeted because we had no alarm, An Garda Síochána states that while it's important to have an alarm, it's only a backup to all of the above precautions and security measures.
And one of the best security measures you can take is ask your neighbours to check in on the house for you and that. Thanks very much, Hannah. Now, yesterday on the programme, we quoted singer Robbie Williams saying he's going through the menopause. He'll be 50 in February and he said the hair is thinning, the testosterone has left the building, the serotonin is not really here, and the dopamine said goodbye a long time ago. But does the male menopause, sometimes called the andropause, really exist? I had some audio problems at my end, obviously not been shared by others, so our apologies to Dr. Brendan O'Shea, Newbridge GP, spokesperson for the Kildare Faculty of the Irish College of General Practitioners and Assistant Professor for Primary Care at Trinity College Dublin, for taking his time yesterday. He has very kindly agreed to rejoin us. And good afternoon, Brendan. And you were saying yesterday that as such, there is no such thing as the male menopause, but that the various symptoms outlined by Robbie Williams are associated with what?
I don't think I said there's no such thing as the male menopause, but I certainly had a feeling of scepticism about it.
Right, okay.
All sorts of things are happening to us all the time. Maybe Robbie's just getting old. And certainly if this was the 1950s or the 1960s or the 1970s, you know, that's what might be said. But it is very convenient and nicer, arguably, to have a disease, preferably a dreadful one, mysterious, that explains everything. But maybe he's getting old. I did the ultimate thing. I went into our electronic medical record system and I looked at ICD-10, which is one of the main ways we categorise or we code for conditions. And andropause and male menopause isn't on it. So the good people at ICD-10 who are very influential don't recognise it as a condition or as a disease.
Okay, and I wanted to emphasise, as I did yesterday, I want to emphasise again, this is not for a second to treat a very serious topic for women of the female menopause in a trite or in a flippant way any whatsoever. But we men are famous for maybe exacerbating or not maybe exacerbating, exaggerating our symptoms. Do you find that, Brendan?
Well, there is the man flu, you know, which has its own background on one hand. And then on the other hand, it's good to look at the men who are in their mid-late 40s, 50s and 60s. And as a group in society, they tend to be reticent and slow about having symptoms looked after or presenting to the doctor. They'd prefer to have all their nails pulled out one by one. The younger crowd are better. But the crowd that are currently going through this particular patch, we could call it the midlife crisis, we don't see them as often, and often things do get very difficult for them. So I think, you know, this is Kildare, it's a horsey county. I think you've got to put a bet both ways for it.
But if there is no such thing as a male menopause, and if we have an idea of what happens with the women, the menopause causes very acute symptoms. I'm reading this, of course, I'm not the doctor. Sparked by the end of ovarian hormonal function, when a woman's egg reserves run out at around the age of 60 and maybe other times. Men have no equivalent physiology, we're told. But yet, on the other hand, as men grow older, and particularly in the 60s, we have what's called low testosterone rates. There's a very fancy word called hypogonadism, I think it is, or functional hypogonadism. So is it not fair enough for men then to claim, if we're undergoing some sort of hormonal change, we can call it the male menopause too, Dr. Brendan O'Shea?
Well, look, people are boss of themselves. People can call it whatever they like. But I think, you know, so we've looked in to see whether it's recognised in the system as a condition, and there isn't great support for it in the system. If you Google HSE plus male menopause, you get a very useful two pages that will put you in the picture. But you've referred to our circulating levels of testosterone and oestrogen, and I think that's a very useful start point for the conversation. It is quite different for women in certain respects. They reach a tipping point, usually towards the end of their 40s or 50s, where their oestrogen level becomes acutely insufficient. Their cycle control in relation to periods goes significantly astray. Periods stop. That's a very visible thing for most women. And a very distressing set of symptoms relates to their blood vessels. They reach a stage of vasomotor instability, meaning that the control of the superficial blood vessels to their skin goes awry because of a lack of estrogen as they're transitioning into a low estrogen state. So periods stop and they get the flushes. And these are very visible things. There isn't an equivalent process for men. Our testosterone levels get gradually less from our 40s, reducing by 1 or 2% compounding each year. So we do reach a low testosterone state, and it's not entirely bad. I mean, arguably, testosterone is a very difficult hormone in certain respects. It certainly contributes to aggression and physicality and impulsiveness and risk-taking. It contributes to libido. And there is a set of problems around all of that in society. So it's not all bad, but it is. And it does happen. Whether we want to make it a disease or a condition or not, I'm not sure that's the most important thing. I think it's more important that if male KFM listeners or their partners are out there listening, if they have these troublesome symptoms, they should have a conversation with the practice nurse, with the GP, with their partner, or do a little bit of careful searching on the internet. And again, I'd refer to the HSE website in this regard.
Indeed, I'm going to refer to that in two ways in a moment. So for men, the lower testosterone, you've got the muscle decline, if you like, in sense, and you've got the old can't get it up anymore, erectile dysfunction. And there is the big psychological barrier, is there not, amongst us men, that if we suffer from erectile dysfunction, we tend to validate ourselves on the basis of how virile we are. And then on the other hand, we're slow to admit it or maybe seek help with that.
We are. And then on the other hand, there are the crowd who are making money out of this.
Yes.
And then there's the big question about, you know, how virile should we remain and for how long? The years do go by. And if we listen to the pharmaceutical sector, for example, again, there's an interest in creating a disease and an expensive remedy for it. But when we're in our middle 60s, life is just not the same as when we were in our middle 20s. And some of us would say, thank God.
you know, speak for yourself, Brendan O'Shea.
It's important to have a philosophical slant to these things.
Yes, indeed. All right. On that note, by the way, and for men or women in regards to issues that we've been talking about, you can visit the HSE website. But also, Mental Health Ireland have a very interesting feature on their website, a pocket guide on how to manage menopause and mental health. To download an online copy, all you have to do is visit their website, which is mentalhealthireland.ie, or you can contact them at info@mentalhealthireland.ie. I'm sure for male or females, but for female, for the pocket guide on that, how to manage menopause. And as Brendan said, Dr. Brendan O'Shea, visit the HSE website for either. Brendan, before you go, I have to say I'm in awe of you and great admiration of you and your colleagues who go to Syria every year. You've been out there lately. Tell us a little bit more what you're doing.
Well, thank you for that. Four Kildare volunteers went out, Karina Hopkins, Michael Hurley, Paul O'Rourke and myself. We go out with AHR twice a year. We go to the border of North Jordan, which borders onto Syria, and we're working with Syrian refugees. There are 800,000 Syrian refugees in northern Jordan. Their conditions are absolutely terrible. They've mainly been locked up there now for between 5 to 10 years. There's a whole generation of children growing up in these camps. So the mission is very efficient. We arrive on a Friday evening and we work quite hard for 6 days, providing a range of medical services and surgical and dental services, women's health and paediatric clinics. It's a the team is a great experience. It's a fantastic collaboration between our volunteers who are coming from Arabic societies, particularly Syrian physicians and nurses and business people who are working around the Gulf, and also American and European volunteers. So there's a fantastic Christian, Muslim, secular mix. And that's a very important validating experience. But the circumstances of these refugees are dreadful. It's very meaningful for them. When we come from Kildare, we fundraised. The generous people of Kildare gave us just over €10,000 to bring out for the purchase of medical supplies. It's very, very meaningful. And it's also relevant to say that at this time it was particularly more difficult because of the situation in Gaza. We were expecting anger, but the predominant feeling was one of profound sadness at what's actually happening. Profound sadness. But again, the position that we've taken in Ireland does have currency, and certainly was recognised in the many conversations that took place around the mission. So it's Atlantic Humanitarian Relief, or the outfit who run it. They're a small US NGO. Some of us in Kildare have been going out for several years. Not myself. I'm reasonably recent to it.
Well, I have to say I'm in awe of it anyway, and I think it's a fantastic service and a fantastic representation of what Ireland and Kildare people and Kildare doctors and medical personnel are providing. Dr. Brendan O'Shea, thank you very much indeed for joining us and taking time out of your very busy Newbridge practice today.
Great pleasure.
Thank you indeed. That's Newbridge, a spokesperson for the Kildare Faculty of the Irish College of General Practitioners and Associate Professor for Primary Care at Trinity College Dublin. You know, they say if you want to do something or get something, give it to a busy man, and there's no one more busier than he is.
Kildare Focus with Clem Ryan.
I'll give you out those numbers again, by the way, that Hannah gave us earlier. I'll go back to you, Hannah, for those numbers on drug and alcohol, etc., 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 before the end of the programme, in case anybody missed it. Right, the number of Gardaí resigning continues to grow, as the Garda Representative Association says. It's not an attractive place to work. Ah, for God's sake. Sure, the Garda, on Garda Síochána, which provides such a fantastic service to us, we're told that they're continuing to resign from the force in increasing numbers. 135 quit so far this year. There were a total of 107 resignations last year. Last month alone, 13 guards resigned while 12 retired. Garda John Joe Connell, good afternoon.
How are you, Clem? How's it going?
Are things that bad? Why people are resigning in those numbers? Yeah. Are they all looking for alternative jobs, is it?
Well, look, we saw this trend, I suppose, in the last 18 months in particular. And we highlighted this to Garda management, and we were told there was no problem here. So we conducted a survey ourselves. We commissioned a study in relation to why this was happening and what was the trend, you know. And
why is it happening, Chanja?
Yeah, well, in the last few weeks we got results, and we issued a report in relation to that. To his in excess of 40 members who have resigned recently, and we asked them why they left, and, you know, I'm not, the list is not kind of, it's not exhaustive, but, you know, everything to do with low morale, buried under the constraints of paperwork and admin, high stress levels, felt victimised in work, unsupported, mental health issues was actually raised a lot, and
okay,
you know, down with unnecessary discipline and suspension protocols, you know, within the job.
Alright, let's take some of those things, because there's a headline today about 646 Gardaí have been injured so far this year.
Yeah.
Commissioner Drew Harris was due before an Oireachtas Joint Committee on Justice today. And obviously saying it's a huge concern, the numbers of Gardaí that are being assaulted. But he was to tell the committee that, and I quote, supporting Garda personnel faced with trauma, crisis or mental health challenges is a priority for him. He was to tell politicians he's fully aware of the safety risks and constant demands of working in policing. He's pledging to invest in continuous training, development and well-being supports. What do you make of all of that then?
Yeah, well, I would, first of all, I'd welcome those comments from the Commissioner, but I suppose if you talk the talk, you have to walk the walk.
Yeah, there's 650 assaults, give or take, there over the, up for a year so far. It will probably reach, you know, the 1,000 mark for 2023, which is similar from previous years, I'll be honest about it. There's up almost half, 300 serious injuries so far this year. Now, that includes open wounds, stabbings, fractures, broken bones, head injuries, and the likes, you know. And you know, then you have your, I suppose, post-traumatic stress disorders from those issues as well, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, they are harder. They're very hard for us to get on Garda Síochána to recognise those as a genuine injury from those stressful situations. But in any event, yeah, a lot of assaults. In relation to the counselling and wellbeing services, yeah, there is counselling there for members. We, from that survey we've conducted, and also face-to-face meetings with members in Kildare, I can tell you, and across the country. So the counselling is there, but it's not good enough. It's up to kind of six short sessions, and that can be extended, but just doesn't feel adequate from our point of view.
And he says he's going to invest in continuous training and development. And on the question of rosters, the commissioner was to tell the committee that he'll try to strike a balance between having sufficient resources to safeguard public safety while ensuring that Gardaí have a predictable roster. It seems on his side, what he's saying is being done and will be done is to address all the issues that you have arisen, yet you threatened to have a vote of no confidence in the commissioner recently.
Well, there actually was a vote of no confidence. We didn't threaten it. We actually, that vote was conducted on a survey of our members.
Have you still no confidence in him then?
Well, that no confidence vote has not been changed. Unless you've heard something in the last couple of hours that I'm not aware of. But I can tell you that vote still stands. And I'm delighted that the commissioner has spoken about these serious issues in the way he has today. I actually haven't heard from that meeting today, but I can't wait to listen back and see what was said and addressed. And we're only delighted if the issues that we've been raising for years and years and years have been addressed today. It's a start, and we would welcome that all our issues that we've raised over the years in relation to the welfare of our members, terms and conditions, rosters, of course, is a huge issue with our members. I can tell you that we have re-entered negotiations with the commissioner, and we hope that, you know, a reasonable outcome for all involved. We acknowledge that the state has to be policed within reason, but we also acknowledge that our members' work-life balance has to be addressed as well.
Okay. On that note, Janjo, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Kildare Focus. That's Garda Janjo O'Connell, who's the Kildare representative on the Garda Representative Association, reflecting on morale and all those resignations. Huge amount, 130 something. Yes, Janjo?
Just in early, before I go, talking about resignations and retirements, our colleague Ronan Mannion, who you have had on your show over the years as well, is retiring next week after 30 years service.
Wow.
And we'd like to, our good colleague Ronan Mannion. So I just want to acknowledge that. His service that he provided to the people around the country. He was in Dublin, but he's been in Naas over 20 years. And we'd like to acknowledge and thank him for that, and best of luck in his retirement.
And we'd like to be associated with that. He's often been here with us on Crime Time during the week, and always a good guy to have aboard as well. And we wish him the very, very best of luck in his retirement. Another one bites the dust, as Queen would say in regards to this. And too many, thank you, Janjo, too many leaving the force, says Garda Janjo O'Connor.